Welcome to Making Docs. I'm Caroline, a freelance documentary director.
And I'm Paul, an aspiring documentary film producer. Follow us on this journey where we speak to industry professionals to get practical advice on the filmmaking process.
In this episode, we're going to talk to Nick Guttridge, who is a professional story consultant and a BAFTA shortlisted documentary executive producer with over 25 years of factual filmmaking experience.
We learn about the art of storytelling and how you can structure your documentary story. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Paul. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is good to be here, Nick. I'm in your place, actually. Set the scene for us, Nick. Where are we exactly?
We have moved my partner's sewing table 6 feet from the window it normally sits under in our newly converted top floor attic bedroom. It's very glamorous, right? It feels just like a movie set, I'm sure.
It is an immaculate place, Nick. You've done a great job on it.
Love to say that you're in some salubrious studio that I own, but maybe next time.
I'm here just wearing my baseball cap, and Caroline is wearing her magician's hat.
Yes, and exactly.
Nick, I don't know why, but we're in your bedroom and you've chose to come naked today.
Yeah, I mean, it's just standard. It's a Tuesday. It's
kind of, yeah. Great. So we'll just jump into it, Nick. Explain to me what a story consultant is exactly.
Okay, so at risk of sounding incredibly pretentious right from the outset, I see it as being something like an editorial Sherpa. And by that, I mean that when you're making a film, it's a bit like climbing a mountain insofar as it's long, it's tortuous, there are obstacles in your way, there are pitfalls to overcome, and not everything goes to plan. So you might find yourself in a situation where your access falls through, or a contributor doesn't quite deliver material in the way that you had expected, or events don't unfold in the way that you had designed them in your imaginary pre-shoot plan. Or you're in an edit suite and you're staring at rushes, not quite sure what move to make next because there's various pathways you could take and you don't quite know which way to go. So the story consultant, I guess, comes in, and as an experienced storyteller, and I like to think a good storyteller, you know, I can help as an objective presence to navigate a path with you and for you to help you with some of that heavy lifting and hopefully get you to the top, overcoming the kind of rockfalls and crevices that we have to deal with, you know, as filmmakers along the way.
So who hires you?
Anyone can hire me. My career has been built through factual programming and documentary in the television sector, principally as a director for 15 years, more recently as a series producer and executive producer. But I've always had a very strong editorial mindset. That's my comfort zone. That's what people have always complimented me on most. So when I started to think about, you know, where can I take these skills and apply them into a different space, that was the obvious place for me to start looking. And so I've worked with everybody from, you know, online content producers to feature documentary filmmakers. You know, compelling storytelling, I think, has some principles that if you're able to get them into your work, just work and make for satisfying, engaging viewing. So that can be applied, you know, from a 5-minute film to a 2-hour film.
It might be a hard one to pick, but just jumping in, the story consultant, with your experience, like, what was your favorite story that you worked on?
There's two that I'd kind of pick out, and it would be in a sort of observational documentary capacity. I love films where you're in the moment with people on their journeys with them. That for me is the ultimate goal in terms of narrative storytelling, because the first person experience is the strongest storyteller, in my opinion. And if you're on the journey with them, you're seeing events unpack, you know, as they're unpacking them, then there's no more real experience for an audience than that. So I was lucky enough to make two films that, a bit of humble brag, got BAFTA shortlisted, which were called Through a Child's Eyes. And the idea behind them was to look at children who were living in quite difficult situations. So one set of kids were living in poverty, the other set of kids were carers for their sick parents. So quite tricky situations. And we filmed the whole thing literally through the child's eyes. So we were never in a room where there was only adults at any point in time. And it was just charting their reality. You know, obviously their big narrative was unfolding over a period of years, and we were dropping into over a period of 8 months or so. But within that, we're able to find smaller storylines that we could explore, which had resolution to them and which allowed us to create something really, you know, quite powerful. And the reason why I like that so much is I brought some preconceptions to it. You walk into someone's house and it's, you know, a place that is not well kept because they don't have a lot of money, and you see a child sleeping on a mattress on the floor and not having, you know, much to eat, and you kind of think, oh, poor you, you know, or I did think, oh, poor you. And actually the child isn't thinking, oh, poor me. The child's a child and that's their experience and their reality and they get on with it. And it was a really sort of eye-opening and mind-opening experience for me as a filmmaker to have my own preconceptions challenged. I mean, of course, the reality is, oh, poor you, because I wish they had more and they will grow up to wish they had more probably. But I was wrong to prejudge that they were having a tough life because in their eyes, that was their life and their parents loved them and it was their normality. And that was, you know, really interesting to see that. And that's why I have done what I've done for these years. You get access to these incredible windows on the world and get to see people's lives and step into them and open your own mind through it and try and show other people, your audience, what the world looks like to other people, which broadens all our minds. And that's, you know, for me, is what good storytelling is about.
What you just described then, Nick, is something that unfolds in real time. You have to respond to it, react to it. It's very difficult to manipulate a story like that because it's just something that's happening. For the directors out there, at what point do you have to start to shape the story as a director? Can you do anything with that?
I think you start shaping a story from the very moment you conceive of that story. Or perhaps it's not conceiving of the story, it's conceiving of the storytelling. You know, a story sort of exists in and of itself. It's, you can have an idea of what that might be. It's got a beginning, it's got a middle, it's got an ending. You know, in this case, the concept would have been, we've got a boy who's suffering with a condition, the beginning, let's find out what his life looks like and what the challenges are that they're facing and what do their parents need to happen to make their lives better for everybody. Then you jump into this middle world where, you know, they're going on this journey through the treatment experience and so forth, and hopefully at the other end, you come out with some sort of conclusion, be it positive or negative, that draws you to an ending. So that's a story. You know, there are stories all over the place. The question is how you tell that story. And every director, every filmmaker will do that in a different way. But I think you start that from the very beginning. You know, there might be an idea that you have or an image that comes to mind, and that image, you know, has a texture to it and a mood about it. It might conjure up a piece of music. It might conjure up a series of shots. You research, you know, around the subject, and it gives you an idea of scenes that might illuminate the story that you're trying to tell. So you can start to map out a series of moments along the way that you can aspire to bring to life through your filming. And as long as they're in keeping with people's realities, they tend to be possible to happen. So it's not about manipulating insofar as trying to create something that isn't true, you know, try and make people do things they wouldn't do, but it's about identifying moments within the possible storyline that might help to develop the narrative that you're aspiring to tell. And it might not go to plan, but that's all part of the process as well. But yeah, you should be always thinking about story and always reassessing story.
And as a filmmaker, how important, like you're kind of describing as well, instincts already, like in a story. And usually filmmakers, especially in documentary filmmaking, directors have these double credits. They are director producers, mm-hmm. or director writers of the story. So ideally, they know the story from the beginning, obviously. But what happens if I kind of shape a story or think the story goes that way? Like, how important are the instincts that might draw me away from the first storyline that I had in mind?
Okay, so I think there's two things there. I think firstly, your instincts are, outside of filmmaking even, your instincts are your compass for your life. And you choose to ignore them at your peril. That's my life lesson, folks. Don't forget about filmmaking. Just follow that rule and you'll be okay. If you follow your instincts, even if it doesn't work out, I think you've done the right thing, personally. From a filmmaking point of view, if you follow your instincts and it doesn't go the right way, chances are, A, you can fix that, but also it may not have gone the right way anyway, is my hunch. You know, dealing with people's lives, if we're talking about unfolding narratives where we're in the sort of first-person experience with people riding that journey with them, you can't predict exactly what's going to happen. You know, things change. So if your instinct is telling you, I don't think this is working out, or I think I should follow this thread instead of the one that I was setting out from, I would absolutely say you should follow it. But what also can happen, which I think is relevant to the point that you're making, is it's not just instincts that can take you off the intended path. You know, the circumstances can as well. And what I've seen a lot is filmmakers who have a plan for what they want to happen and things don't go to plan, and then they panic, or they think it's all gone wrong, or they go home or whatever, they pack their bags or whatever. They don't embrace the change. They're stuck in this idea that I've got this plan and I'm going to make this plan. And you just can't force something down a road that it doesn't want to go down and do it authentically.
Did you ever receive a call from a filmmaker who had a storyline and like called crying for help? Nick, please help me. I screwed up. I don't know where this is going.
No, but but I can. There's a couple of instances where I've had a call at the end of a day from the front line of the shoot, and what I've been told is that it all went wrong and that the plan's gone to pieces or whatever. And I'll start talking to them about, okay, so what happened? Talk me through what happened. And they'll tell me what happened. And I can see why they're a bit worried about it because it hasn't gone quite to plan. But we talk it through some more and we start to think, okay, so that's quite interesting. You know, this thing they did then, you know, we can make something of that. And we get to the end of the conversation and I'm feeling quite positive about it, you know, as someone who's in a more kind of consultancy supervisory capacity going, okay, don't worry, you know, we'll save this. And then they'll be like, oh yeah, but I didn't film any of it because it wasn't right. It's like, oh,
no.
Okay. So we just had this conversation about what actually happened and with a view to trying to solve the problem, and we don't have any of that stuff. So it has gone wrong now, hasn't it? Because you didn't get anything that we can now work with. So and that's my point really is, you know, even if you're not quite sure how it's going to play out, you know, follow, trust, and then figure it out. You know, there'll be something that will happen that can spark another idea or a new direction, almost certainly that you can latch onto and make something great out of.
Nick, my instincts are terrible. So... with my bad instincts, I don't want to rely on them. So what is the best process for actually crafting a story at the beginning of the journey?
Okay,
because I'm going to stick to it.
Let me just address the first point. You need to work on this.
I need to work on my instincts. Okay,
but in all seriousness, I know that's not your reality. No, because you're a hugely instinctual
instincts.
Person.
Yes.
I mean, the very fact that you thought let's set this table up in this corner of this attic room shows me the strength of your instincts.
With a naked man,
woman, a magician's hat. Yeah, absolutely. But as a filmmaker, you need to make decisions. You know, it's key. You need to direct things. That means taking control of situations, having ideas, trusting your gut on things. If you're not able to do that, then you have a problem from the outset. You know, I think you're unlikely to make the best work possible if you're not prepared to take a leap and go for it. And most people do have an instinct. It might be that they're nervous about following things through. It might be that they're working with people who are more experienced than them and they're a bit intimidated by what people will think, you know, or whatever it might be. Or they're not experts in a field. They're relying on, you know, talking to another, to an expert, and they feel a bit second rate or whatever. But, you know, you're the director. You're in that space to create a film. The people who are there with you know you're there for that purpose. You have more power than you might think you have. And so act like you've got great instincts, act like you've got decisions in your head, and just follow it through. Would be my top tip to you if that was your actual reality.
I'll pretend.
We'll work on that.
But what was the question that you wanted me to answer after building you up from self-esteem point of view?
I suppose I'm looking for the nuts and bolts of the process to kind of mapping the journey of a story that might happen.
Okay.
Because you start out at the start of the project and you think, I've got this great character or person, I've got this amazing access, what's the next step?
Okay, that's hard. That's a hard one because there are so many different ways stories can go. There are so many different types of storytelling. What we've discussed so far, principally because it's where I feel most excited, is that unfolding first person narrative. What you want to aspire to have is first person accounts of things. So talk to the people who were there or who are going to be there in the story. They're your best possible storytellers. Secondarily to that, make sure that you have a situation where one of those people who is your lead character, if you like, has something at stake in the course of whatever journey they're going on. If you've got a good character who can tell you that story, you experience it through their eyes, and they've got something on the line, then you've got the heartbeat of an interesting journey. I don't like to talk down of any any film because criticism is subjective, but there's two interesting films about the Fire Festival. Then, if you've come across that,
I've seen the Netflix one.
Okay, so there's fire and there's fire fraud, and for those that haven't seen it, this was an event. I don't know what year it was, relatively recently. A chap called Billy McFarland, I think, had this grand vision to start this A-list festival. in a remote island, which was going to be the ultimate influencer-based festival, and it would have all the A-list stars. They'd be there, and he sold tickets at God knows what price, and anyone who wanted to be connected to, you know, the cool kids in town was going to be there and wanted to be there and bought tickets. And the whole thing flopped because he couldn't deliver on that promise. Great story, right? We can sell, from the outset, we can see it's a great story, and we've got two films that go at that story. So we were saying earlier on, different filmmakers make things different ways. You know, they've got the same story here and they're going to tell it in two different ways. Fire, the one that you've seen, the Netflix film, is entirely told through what I would call the henchmen in the story. You know, the people that were kind of on the periphery of it, intimately involved in the story, but they weren't Billy McFarland. So they're the people who kind of experienced it, saw his ego, saw his madness, saw whatever it might be, and we're on the journey with them. Fire Fraud has a bit of that as well, but they've also got Billy McFarland in it. So you would think, this is going to be the film that I want to see. Yeah. Billy McFarland himself is going to tell us what this is all about, okay? Billy McFarland in this film is a terrible, terrible character, okay? And the film has got, in my opinion, has got us...
the way he comes across.
Yeah, it's an interview set up with him, and he's obviously very cagey or nervous or something's going on there, and you can feel the filmmakers trying to make it seem important and wanting his words to add value to the piece. And in my view, it doesn't work at all. And there's these moments where they're trying to latch onto pauses and silences to try and draw some drama out of it. And these are good filmmaking techniques, but in the context of this interview, it just doesn't work. And I think it's compounded by the fact that he's the guy you want to be hearing from. If you've got this guy in your film, surely he's going to make this film great. You know, you're going to get this from the horse's mouth, but no. Not helped also by the fact, I think structurally, it's a little bit more scrappy. I think Fire was a really well-made film. You're on a journey with them. You're riding the coattails of people as the timeline unfolds. It's really well-structured. But, you know, really interesting. And so my point is about character. You know, so you've got someone there who should be, on paper, would be your A-star character, but in filmmaking terms, doesn't. So that would be my kind of top sort of starting points, is when you identify a story that you want to tell, make sure you're then looking for the people through who you can tell it, and make sure those people have something at stake for them, and then you're on a journey with them. And that's what good storytelling needs at its core.
How does the typical story arc work, Nick?
So a story arc is like a story roller coaster in reality. It's classic. I mean, there are lots of schools of thoughts on best ways to tell a story. And there's a lot of people who would agree that they tend to fall into a pattern. And I think I'm probably one of them, which is that, you know, your hero, for want of a better phrase, sets out on a journey. Well, you've got a bit of backstory to start with to set the scene, sets out on a journey because he's got something to solve or something to get or, you know, whatever it might be. He's fully armed, he's going out with a mission, everything feels great, and then he encounters trouble. So your arc kind of goes up initially, and then something happens along the way, and he takes a knock, which drags him back down again. And at the bottom of that knock, something will then hopefully happen that will pick him up again and off we go. So ups and downs are kind of what we're looking for. And some resolution at the end. Now, that could be a simple up, down, up, or it could be an up, down, up, down, up, down. Or, you know, it doesn't matter. It could be an up, down, plateau, down, up. Doesn't matter. But what you're looking for is texture in the storytelling. You know, you don't want a one-note piece. And that's why I think a lot of films, a lot of documentaries will revolve around events where there's jeopardy built in to them, because if there's jeopardy there, then there's unpredictability, and unpredictability brings character flaws to the surface and you know, it gives you a ride with somebody, which is interesting.
What if there are no ups and it's just down, or the other way around? So what if it's just up and you don't get the down moments in the story that you're trying to film? So for example, if you've got someone who's trying to achieve a goal, and they continue, it's going great, and they get it.
Yeah.
And then you've thought, oh, actually, they didn't struggle.
Right.
And there were no down moments. So as a story consultant, how would you fix that?
Yeah.
Is that possible?
So, what we're looking at there is, so I guess the first thing that I would say is, in picking your story, we want to be hoping that that's not going to be the case insofar as you pick something that has challenges attached to it. So there's something
bad luck.
it needn't be failure that we're looking for. It might just be wrestling with something that is got to be overcome in order to carry on that journey. You know, it's just something that you can latch onto. And I think that is my answer to your question, is what you're looking for then becomes layers that you can bring into the story. So if they're off on this adventure, you know, why are they doing that adventure? Let's start to explore that. Maybe there's something in their childhood that's compelling them to be this. So
prepare for the for the difficult moments to come.
Exactly. And try and find, be interested in the people that you're telling the story about. Okay, it's not just about watching this random person going on a great adventure. It's getting inside their mind, getting inside their spirit. You know, who are they? Take me on a journey with them. Let me understand their complexities. Let me understand how the world around them feels about them a little bit. That's where you start getting layers that make it a really interesting story, because it's no longer two-dimensional. Free Solo. You know, great film. And there's a situation where you've got, you know, a chap who's an expert mountain climber. Mm-hmm. He's taking on the biggest challenge of his life. Spoiler alert. He's still alive as far as I know right now. So he completes the challenge. So you could argue...
Damn it, Nick, I haven't seen that yet. No.
But there's ups and downs along the way. You know, he panics a little bit, you know, midway through and drops out of an earlier attempt. The filmmakers didn't know that was going to happen. Their expectation, I think, would have been that he did the climb and hopefully got to the top, because for them, the only option in their mind was, if he doesn't get to the top, he's dead. You know, so that's not what they want as their ending for the film, you know. So they, in their minds, I imagine they're on a kind of linear trajectory with this chap who is going to take on this journey.
What if he doesn't have any difficult moments? So it is just something that he goes from A to B and he struggles it.
There's a question to be asked there over, is the challenge significant enough and big enough for this to be really the subject that you want to make your film about? But even then, people are complex. You know, there's stuff going on inside this guy that he's wrestling with, or his family are wrestling with. The girlfriend in that film is a really interesting character, you know, because she doesn't want him clearly to be doing this stuff, and he's blind to her feelings, you know, and adds a layer. And so now we've got some darkness or some concerns from her that are coming through. And because he's our hero, we're rooting for him, there's now something we're feeling, this tussle between the two of them, and we're witnessing it unfold in front of the camera, which is brilliant, is great. What they also did, which I thought was really clever and important, was involve the film crew in the storytelling in that case. So my first thought when I realised what this film was about is, this man's going to climb this 3,000 foot high, you know, rock face without ropes. That's quite difficult, right? And now what he's going to have is a camera in his face. Surely the last thing you want is distractions. You know, any thought of anything other than what's in your front focus can't be good. And they made that part of the narrative. And actually the camera crew, you know, desperately worried themselves that this guy might end up falling through their frame and dying as a part of this process. That's interesting. That's textural. You know, there's some depth, there's some downs in there. Exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of what we're looking for. And I'd hold it up as a really good example of a successfully told story, you know, with some very interesting storytelling because of that.
And you brought up something really interesting in terms of the filmmakers being part of a story or being part of a film. So talking about Werner Herzog, who usually narrates his stories, Michael Moore, who's obviously part of, like, huge activist in the forefront in his stories as well. What do you think about that? Like, were you ever part of a film where maybe the filmmaker didn't want to be part of the story, but you kind of suggested you better be, because it's you, I want to, like, you have to show me like what's going on? Or the other way around, where the filmmaker said, I want to be part of the story, and you were like, nope.
I have been a part of a film where it was my suggestion to put the filmmaker into the story. Why did I do that? Because it's a tricky subject, and the filmmaker is a charismatic guy, and he had a clear vision for what he wanted his film to be doing, and it wasn't entirely clear from the material that we were going to be able to tell the story that he wanted to tell in a way that would be very easily understood by the audience. He had it, the story was there, but it was complex. Putting him into the film means that you have a guide straight away. So editorially, we can now shape this story because we have a sort of investigative voice, if you like, running through it, which is helpful. It's something that if you were making in television, we use commentary, you know, a lot, less so in sort of feature docs and so on. But, you know, it's used as a technique. But it's a way, if you like, of being able to put some commentary into it and take some ownership of the storyline, where you're not relying entirely on the success of your interviews doing it. And this particular film was dealing with quite complex science. And if you're interviewing medical experts about complex science, you get sometimes quite complex medical answers. So just being able to go beneath that helped me as a layperson understand what we're talking about. We need some device there. Mm-hmm. And because this was a very personal film for the filmmaker, it was a natural thing to suggest, and he was open to it. And so that's the journey that we've gone on. One disadvantage of it, I think, and this would depend on the structure of the film being made and the kind of support around it, is you said earlier on, Caroline, about how these days people have multiple credits on things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes one person does everything.
Yeah.
And you know, an author, director, whatever, you know, that there are.
When you're starting out as a filmmaker, I mean, you have to.
Absolutely. Yeah. There are built-in dangers with that, especially actually if you're starting out and perhaps you haven't got that experience of storytelling under your belt, because working in a creative vacuum, it is unlikely, I would dare to suggest, to produce the best possible story that you could ever have. At some point, you need to be having somebody offer you that support or perspective. You're not the audience for your film unless you're a very self-indulgent filmmaker. Not only can you not be sure that it's going to resonate with a bigger audience, but actually, I know this from my own first-hand experience as a filmmaker, you can sometimes think that you're getting a certain message across in a way because you know the subject very well, and actually when you sit back and watch it from the outside, it's not quite as clear. So having that extra voice in your creative world is helpful. And to say that's where the story consultant sort of idea comes in as well, just having that bit of collaboration and someone who's on your team who you can trust, who can just help to give that perspective, you know, that can perhaps allow you to see things that you hadn't seen before.
We can support each other, Paul.
Yeah.
You can be right.
Yeah, or mum and dad. You know, they're always around.
Yeah,
they're always supportive.
Yeah, mum and dad are probably too supportive. I think they're not necessarily the objective voices that you want to tell you that your film's going to be great.
But that's probably the headache for all filmmakers, thinking about directors, thinking about funding especially. Yeah. So I'm going to throw a few things they always ask about is storyline, synopsis, treatment.
Okay.
Can you break it down? What is it? What do I need for it?
I can tell you what I think they are.
Yeah.
and have other people disagree
Fair
with
enough.
Me. I think a storyline and a synopsis are kind of the same thing. I think what comes to my mind there would be a short summary, almost an elevator pitch of what this film is going to be about. So Free Solo, we've talked about, you know... sorry, wrong piece of paper. Let me get it.
Nick's got a mountain of notes that he's prepared for this.
I'll pick that up. Okay, so Free Solo, for example, you could say you're following climber Alex Honnold on a literal life or death attempt to reach the top of a sheer 3,000 foot tall rock face without any ropes. You know, that's a short, honest take of what it is. Well, that's it's a synopsis. Exactly. You'd watch that, right? So then you've pitched that and someone goes, yeah, sold, great, tell me more. At which point you go and write a treatment. And the treatment then would be more fleshed out. It could be as long as you want, but a page, 2 pages, something where you're starting to put down more about the structure, the style. We're starting to think about the layers that might seep into the storyline as well. It's not the film, but it's going to give us texturally an idea of what we're going to be seeing now if it's actually getting made.
Just on the treatment, if you have to sell your film in to get funding, you're going to have to prepare a treatment and a synopsis. So at that point in the journey of the film, you might be at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. So you've mapped out this incredible story of what could happen, but ultimately that might change. So how do you sell that in with the treatment, knowing that this might, you just have to put your best story forward and think it's going to hopefully end up this way?
I think the filmmaking industry knows how filmmaking works. If you're pitching a retrospective story, then hopefully you can be pretty certain of what that story is going to be. And then what you might want to be saying is, as part of this, we've got access to X, Y, Z. So we've got access to these locations. We're going to speak to these key people who were part of it. Maybe you can send even a little tape of people that you've interviewed, you know, in short form, just to kind of give a taste of what it is to try and bolster the pitch that you've got. If you're dealing with an unfolding narrative, then obviously anything can happen to a point. I mean, hopefully not anything can happen, but things might not go to plan. That's fine. You know, what people are buying into is the vision that you're selling, and enough bits of that jigsaw puzzle are going to be still in place at the end for it still hopefully to be worthwhile. What there will be along the way is ongoing conversations at all levels creatively to manage expectations and to deal with, you know, problems as they crop up and find good solutions to that. Because once people have invested their money in something, they want to make sure they're going to get a good return on that investment. But I wouldn't worry about that. I would just say, you know, stack the cards as heavily as you can in your favor, sell the best story that you can, an honest story. You know, you want to pitch them something that you believe generally can play out, get them excited about that. But if there are variables attached to it, then that's fine. You know, I'm sure any I don't want to talk about free sell all the time, because I've got it in my head now. But I'm sure when that was pitched to financiers, you know, no one knew how that was actually going to play out. There was a real possibility that might have ended in a horrendous tragedy. Mm-hmm. They took a punt on it because this guy is great at what he does.
So, and we've got this guy, he's going to climb a mountain and he's going to fall off.
Yeah, I don't know if they would buy that.
Couldn't put that one forward.
I'm not sure if they'd buy that. But just in terms of the pitch, if you like, three different films that are kind of doing similar things for the audience. So Free Solo is a first-person story in the moment, actuality-based, following this guy climbing a mountain. Okay, mm-hmm. Loads at stake for him, life or death, mm-hmm. and a great watch as a result of that. Mm-hmm. Man on Wire, classic film, another first-person testimony about the chap who crossed the Twin Towers on a tightrope. Mm-hmm. Another crazy man, everything's at stake for him, he might fall. Archive. Based. Okay, so we still got the same things going on for the audience. It's a first person testimony. There's loads at stake here. Perhaps the jeopardy's not so much because this guy is sitting in a room talking to you and you know it's happened in the past in Man on Wire, whereas in Free Solo, we're not quite sure where we're going to be going yet. You know, is he still alive at the end of it? But what the trigger points emotionally and the tension that they can evoke for an audience are kind of in similar territory. Into the Void, what's it called? Touching the Void, which were, again, similar territory, set in Peru.
As well.
Caroline's homeland.
Is that Peru? I didn't know that.
The Peruvian Andes. Yes.
That is reconstruction based, you know, but again, you've got first person testimony from the climber who, again, takes you on this extraordinary journey as a result of that. So you've got three very different approaches to films that are actually doing a similar thing in terms of the way the audience will engage with them. Touching the Void and Man on Wire, those pitches, you know, we know what the story is. So then it comes down to how are you going to tell this story in a way that's going to make it interesting. Assuming you've got the access, which is the core thing to your pitch, and we've got the protagonists involved here, they've signed up to this, they're on board with us. If you agree to fund this film, how are you then going to bring that to life? That's the question that people are going to be wanting to have answered, assuming that they like the film. Free Solo, there's a bigger leap of faith there because we can see this could be incredible, but we don't know how it's going to end. So there's a bit more unpredictability there for the finances as to how it's going to go, because would a film where someone dies at the end be as compelling for an audience as one who achieves the goal? Maybe, quite possibly, but it's a bit more unpredictable at that point in time.
What are the common challenges that doc makers face when trying to tell a story and crafting the story?
There are many.
Okay. But the common ones that you come across as a story consultant.
Where people go wrong?
You say, yeah, so when they bring you in, Nick, what is the common reason that they bring you in?
So it's normally because they've lost sight of what the story is in some way. And that can happen for a number of reasons. So top tip again, before you go out on your shoot, have a plan. There is a kind of sort of adage that you make things in the edit, and that's absolutely true, of course. You make a film in the edit, but what you give to the edit, you know, is the product of the shoot, and what you deliver on the shoot is in large part a result of what you plan before you end up going out on the shoot. So have a plan, know what the story is, know how you want to tell it.
So when I'm planning the story and crafting it at the beginning, on a practical level, how does that work? So am I using post-it notes on a wall? Am I using an Excel document? Is there a formula to this?
I use post-it notes are really good. Okay. And I also I carry notebooks with me wherever I go and just jot stuff down. You know, I think when I was directing more, you live the film. You know, it's in your head all the time, and random moments will strike you. You're walking down the street doing some shopping, or you're on the tube train or whatever, visiting your mum, and something will pop into your mind that will inspire you, or maybe I could try that and make a note. And these things over time form into bigger ideas that you think you might be able to use in some way. I don't think there is a right or wrong way. You just got to bite the bullet. One of the hardest things about the process is sitting down at a blank piece of paper or a blank screen and starting to actually write your script. You might have your synopsis sorted because you know what you're trying to achieve. You then might think you can flesh it out into a treatment that feels quite punchy. But before you start the shoot, strongly recommend that you actually put together, you know, a script, which may be in large part fictional, but it gives you a proper roadmap of where this story might get to. Even if you don't know exactly what's going to happen, you can hazard a guess at where things might go. And it just helps you creatively get into the right space.
Now, when you say script, I just have this imagination of a really thick script with dialogue and
no.
and all that. So give me an example of a script.
You're probably looking at 15, 20 pages of stuff. I mean, it's not a small piece of work, but what you're doing is plotting the arc. You know, we talked about that earlier on. You know, what's this journey going to be? What are the possible ups and downs within it? What are the layers that we're going to try and weave in to help reveal story? Where in the unfolding of the narrative might those things play out? How are we going to do that? Are we going to do them as master interview, or are we going to do them in situ, you know, on location at the end of a certain event that's happened? You know, it's just starting to get the creative juices flowing, making the decisions that feel like you're unpacking a proper story. So when you set out on day one, because day one of the shoot probably will go the way that you wanted it to, because you know, it's just starting, at least you've got a sense of where you're setting off to go. And then you can twist and turn a little bit along the way. If it goes off the rails a little bit, you can often bring it back, actually, to where it wants to be. But if it doesn't, that's fine. You're off on a whole new adventure. But you're still probably broadly heading for the same
place. He's got to write a whole new script.
You should definitely keep on evaluating that script. Okay. Definitely. Yeah, definitely. So yeah, the script that you write before you start the shoot is not going to be the same script that you have going into the edit, and it won't be the same script you have at the end of the edit either.
I have seen some filmmakers use the post-it notes on the walls to kind of plot out what might happen and where it meets the arc, or moving parts of the story around to fit the arc in terms of moments and post-it notes. Is that typical, or is there other ways of doing it?
Yeah, post-it notes are really helpful because it's a very easy visual thing to do.
A big blank wall.
If we were sitting down in my office at the back rather than in this attic room, you'd see post-it notes all along the wall for a film that I was working with collaborator, you know, not long ago, and they're still up there because I like that story. I wanted to just kind of keep it up there for a while.
Just make sure that they're sticky.
And post-it. You can move them around.
That's why, because you can start to experiment with stuff. How's that feel next to this? You know, this is how the edit shapes up. You know, I'm involved with a project at the moment for Channel 5. We've got two edits running at the moment, and walls are covered with post-it notes. You know, it's exactly how we do it. You know?
Which is great. Yeah. I have another struggle to add as a foreign filmmaker living in London, and I think like me, there are many other people you mentioned. I'm from Peru, beautiful Peru, with a lot of beautiful stories, beautiful landscapes, and a lot of llamas, as Paul keeps pointing out.
Gotta love a llama.
You gotta love a llama. So like me, there may be other filmmakers finding their stories on a travel, or because they're also from another country, and so many beautiful characters sitting somewhere in another part of the world, which is a different culture. So how can I bring a story? Because I kind of think I live in London, I want to sell it to a British audience, or maybe even British funding, trying to find European funding. So how can I sell a story that might be a little bit peculiar? Is it in the end about finding the universal in that story, like bringing it down to a theme? Is that it?
You and I talked about this before. And that's exactly...
I consulted Nick before.
Yes, that's exactly what I would say. I mean, I think television is quite a closed-minded world in the UK, insofar as we like UK-based stories, because that what telly's trying to do is to appeal to the most possible people. You know, people select the programmes that they watch on a whim, and so they want to feel that they're giving their audience something that's going to be an easy thing for them to stick with. And there's a perception, wrongly I hope, that British stories play best, but that's television. You know, there are obviously a huge number of other routes to getting your work out there, but I think the problem still remains that people want to engage with things they see a connection to, and something that feels a little bit obscure or not of our world. You know, there's a reason why newspapers cover American stories and Australian stories and European stories here, but we don't hear too much about Malaysia. You know what I mean? It's until planes go missing. You know, then it becomes a universally interesting story, because this plane went missing. How can that possibly happen? Do you know what I mean? So I think that's exactly right, Carolyn. Yeah, what you need to be doing is using your story as a platform to speak about something bigger and more revealing, or to tap into emotions and allow us to empathize with things that are universally understandable.
Nick, you've mentioned a couple of top tips of your top tips before. What other tips do you have for filmmakers out there?
Right.
Oh, he's grabbing one of his many notes.
No, I've got a top five. I think it's top five because I knew you'd ask me this one.
Okay.
We've touched on a lot of these, but there's good reason for that. They're important things where people can go wrong, but if you get them right, then things tend to fall into place, you know, a bit better. So first thing, have a strong plan before you go out to shoot.
Yeah.
Are we agreed? Are we on board with that? Okay, yeah. Great. Have a plan. Don't worry, that plan may change. Have a plan. All right, number one. At the end of the shoot, get to know the material that you shot, it will have changed. Your sense of story will have changed from the beginning to the end. And you'll hopefully be on top of that because it's not happened in isolation. You've been part of that process. You've been out on shoots, you know, when things have happened or gone a bit differently. So you know what you've got. But actually, having a bit of time to sit back, watch your material without an editor breathing down your neck, without the pressure of financiers or whatever banging on your door, just get to know your material, sit there with an open mind, open eyes, and just see what you've really got. Sometimes you'll find things in your material that you hadn't realised that you've got.
So practically, how would you do that? I'm guessing that you would export all the footage from your cards, your memory cards. You would open up your editing software and you would lay all of that down into one timeline.
Depending on how many rushes you've got.
Based on date and time order.
Yeah.
And then go through it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And use it as an opportunity to make notes. You know, if you've got editing skills yourself, then you can start to make little pulls of, you know, sync, as we would call it, you know, the content that you feel has a chance of making it into the film, because there'll be a lot of rubbish there. You know, I mean, I often say that a film is the 5% that's left when 95% of what you've done over the last 6 months is on the cutting room floor, you know, and that's, of course it is, because you want the best bits, you want the kind of key moments. So identifying what those are and starting to put little bins together with all those material, that material in it, is time well spent. But it's not just about organising the material for the edit, it's about giving yourself the space to actually watch it objectively, if you like, for the first time.
At that stage, is it not normal to be a bit worried about what you have? Because you kind of watch it and think, okay, I maybe missed this, I've missed that, and you might start to get a bit negative about the film.
Right. That can happen. Okay. I mean, I think it is a given, I think, that 100% of directors only focus on the negative at the end of a day's filming. You know, things that go right have gone right. Things that go wrong are the things that you focus on. Yeah, and so, you know, that can be something that brings you down. But actually, that's the point here, is that what you're now looking at is your reality. So I think it's more likely, hopefully, that at the end of a day's filming, you might go, that didn't go to plan, and possibly have a start. We talked about it already, but have a wobble at that point in time, saying, oh, it's all gone to pieces. Yeah, I don't know what to do now. By the time you get to the edit, or just before the edit, you've now got what you've got. So now let's start to look at it through fresh eyes and see how we can turn what went right into something that can be great, you know. And that's what I mean by sitting back and just taking a cool look on it dispassionately and letting the great stuff kind of hit you. And there'll be loads of it, you know. It might not be what you set out to make, but throw that away now, because now here's your reality, is what's on these hard drives. So focus on those and start to build a new story, which is loosely based on what you've come up with already, but will be different before you actually attack the edit.
Yeah.
And then you're writing another script, sort of going into the edit, and you can approach the edit with more confidence.
So it's plan.
Yeah, plan and know the rushes. Reevaluate throughout. Again, so every day at the end of a shoot, you know, how's this gone? When you're in the middle of a shoot, how's this going? The brain should be whirring constantly. It's an exhausting job being a filmmaker. If you're also shooting your own material, which many people do, doubly exhausting, because your head's in three different places. You're sound recording, you're directing, you're camera operating.
So not just going through the motions, really.
You've really got to dial into it. Yeah. Really dial into it. And actually, it makes the days go quicker and makes the job more interesting when you're able to do that, because what you want to be thinking about all the time is, what's the good bits? What am I interested in here? Am I hearing stuff that I might want to use? Great, let's keep on filming. Am I thinking about stuff now, you know, about my lunch or about about what I'm doing tomorrow? Maybe I've zoned out of what they're talking about. Hopefully that's because it's not as interesting. At which point you can make a decision. Do I carry on filming, or do I stop filming, or do I jump in there and redirect it in some way to pick up on something they said earlier that was interesting that I might end up using? Yeah, but keep that going. And we talked earlier on about the importance of making decisions. Which brings me to my next point, actually, which is direct. You know, there are many people who come back with rushes, and I hear their voice not once in the space of the 3 hours of filming done in a certain day. I don't know how that's directing. It's possible they just pressed off on the camera every time they said something, but I would expect to be hearing a director chipping in,
right,
questioning, not just observing, you know, dispassionately. There are films that are made in that very, very kind of pure observational way, but the volume of material that you would have to generate to create a compelling story is unfathomable to me. And you can just shortcut all of that by just being a bit more in the moment and jumping in a little bit more. Yeah. And then my kind of classic tip, open with impact. When you get into the edit, and before you get into the edit, make sure you've got something up your sleeve that is going to hook us in from the word go. It's the most exposed part of a film, the beginning. And I would equate it to when you have a comedian walk on stage. If they tell a cracking first joke, you get a lot of goodwill from the audience as a result of that, that carries you along for the next 5-10 minutes. And they might still blow it down the road, but you've got them for a period of time. If they walk on stage, say something, and no one laughs, then that's a pretty tough crowd to win over. So it's worth really thinking about how you can open with impact. The much ridiculed documentary that I totally loved called After the Screaming Stops, which is about the 80s band Bros.
Oh, I love that. I love that film. Where can we find it? Is that the BBC iPlayer? I think it might be.
I think it is. It might also be on Netflix, actually.
Just Google it.
Yeah, Google it. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I loved it. I have to say, I believe it's a great documentary. I think I could be clouded slightly by nostalgia because Bros were definitely part of my teenage years, to the point where when I had hair, because I haven't got hair anymore, listeners, I went and asked for a Bros haircut, guys, back in the day. Yes, I walked in with a copy of Smash Hits magazine back in the day to a barber and asked for a Bros haircut.
Do you have an earring?
I did not have an earring, Paul.
Okay. But I'm didn't glad, quite have the Bros look.
I'm glad you're not questioning the fact I had hair. That's more but anyway, I thought this was a really interestingly made film about brothers more than anything else. But it opens with a scene backstage in a dressing room and basically a conversation between the brothers, which is a moment that plays out at length later in the film, which they're just pricey at the start. And it descends into a massive argument, swearing at each other. One storms off, if I remember rightly. And I'm just remember being hit by that, thinking, okay, this is interesting, because I don't often see people, even if they're slightly washed up celebrities, I don't often see people who are in the limelight revealing themselves with their guard down in this way. So immediately I'm interested in what they've got to say to me next. So what they've done there is start with a moment that actually plays out towards the end of the film, I think, in reality. But it's a great move because they've just got me sitting up taking notice right from the start.
Mm-hmm. Excellent example. Thanks for your time today, Nick.
Pleasure, mate.
And I've got a feeling I'm going to need a story consultant
good
at some point. So where can we find you, Nick?
So you can find me via my website, which is thestoryconsultant.co.uk. I also post storytelling tips on Instagram a couple of times a week at thestoryconsultant. It's actually the_story_consultant, but if you type the story consultant, magically
you'll
it turns
find
up.
It.
And I've put together a series of workshops, which, you know, I'd love to have people come along and hear what I have to say. There'll be information about that on the website, and hopefully I can keep you guys up to date with what's going on. If people want to find out more, then they can get in touch.
Well, what we found out is that we all need a storytelling consultant, I
think.
Yeah,
we do. And I'm going to give you your bedroom back, and you can get changed.
Thank you. I'm just in clothes.
Get some clothes. Yeah.